You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey y'all, spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. In this week's episode, we're diving deeper into the mysterious life of the platypus. If you haven't heard part one, you should go check that out. As a reminder, I'm not claiming platypuses are monsters, but they may be the closest thing in real life to the chimera from ancient Greek mythology, an animal comprised of the parts of other animals. We're going to learn about these animals and their amazing sense organs, their venomous spurs, and how they can also be secret agents who wear fedoras. Actually, you'll have to check the show notes to learn more about that last thing. But we're picking right up where we left off with Dr. Gilad Bino, who's been studying these creatures for a while and has lots to share with us.
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
Monster Talk.
I want to ask Gilad, they're so cute. They're so I think they're adorable looking creatures, but I've heard that they're dangerous. So could you tell us what happens if you touch a platypus?
So like almost anything here in Australia, it's they're you know, the wildlife here and plants are quite dangerous.
Often, yeah.
It's quite often. Yeah, it's for me, like I'm not, I didn't grow up in Australia. So I came from, I came to Australia about 12 years ago and maybe a bit more, 15 years ago. Come to terms that like it's the going out into the bush, what we call here in Australia, is can be quite intimidating. Everything here seems to kind of want to get you. So platypuses, they have venomous spurs. And so the male platypus have these spurs. They're about 10 to 13 millimeters long on their hind legs. So they have these two spurs on their hind legs. It's kind of on like where you would think maybe like the ankle, I guess, would be. Okay. Female platypuses are born with a tiny spur, like a vestigial spur, a remnant spur that disappears after about 6 months. And so the males have these spurs. I've never been spurred, but from accounts of other people, they can carry quite a punch. Being envenomed by a platypus can lead to excruciating pain for up to 6 months.
Wow.
So yeah, it's like it's a muscle toxin. And so the pain is like, if you get spurred in the arm, you know, it would be immobilizing pain. You just have to splint your arm and not try not to move it. And apparently like morphine and painkillers, they don't help.
Wow. It must be rare though for that to happen.
Like they don't, platypuses, they don't go out for you. So it's not like you'll be swimming in a pool and be surrounded by venomous platypus. So
stories to the contrary are spurious. Yep.
nice one. that's a recommendation I give to anyone is like that, you know, avoid trying to handle a platypus. And if you handle, if you have to handle a platypus, so anglers, you know, if you go fishing, sometimes you come across stories of platypus getting caught. And unfortunately, like what happens is that when that happens, the anglers, they just cut their line. And then we sometimes come across dead platypus with fishing lines wrapped around their neck. And so, you know, So that's kind of it. Like, ideally, you'd have to like reel it in and try and take the hook out of the platypus's bill. But there's a way to handle platypus. So when I handle a platypus, it's, mostly they're in the net or in the water, and you really have to assume it's a male until proven otherwise. And I hold them by the tip of the tail. And that's really how to handle platypuses. I haven't talked about that maybe, but there's quite a difference in size variation between platypuses, males and females, and across their range. So like I was describing earlier, how they extend, from really tropical to alpine climates. And so the colder the climate, the bigger the platypuses become. And so it's quite one of these like ecological, physiological laws in terms of like thermoregulation of animals in terms of the ratio of mass to size. And so down south and like in Tassie, the platypuses are much bigger. They get up to about, so a male platypus would be about 60 centimeters long. You want to convert that to inches for our international listeners, American listeners?
That is 23.6 inches. So just under 2 feet.
Yeah. So, that's with tail. So, but they're pretty big.
Yeah.
The males can weigh up to like 2, 2.5, maybe like 2 kilos. I have this funny story if you want to hear.
Sure.
It was like a scene from The Exorcist. So when I catch platypuses, all my work is at night. We set nets. We go, we wait, we check. We get that platypus. And we take a, when we catch a platypus, we put it in a pillowcase and tie the pillowcase and put it in the car for safekeeping until we're ready to what we call like process them, to look, go over them and check their condition and take samples and all of that. So I load up the car with platypuses and pillowcases so I can have six platypuses there. That's the most, but usually it's, two or three. I take them and I'll like wrap them in a towel, because they're a bit wet. And so if it's cold or hot, I monitor their condition and all of that. And I check up on them because when I'm ready to process them, I I don't want to stress the animals. That's like something that's been really important for me. And so I anesthetized the platypuses. I've got this like mobile station and I gassed them out. And then while they're sleeping, I can check them. So I can't do that while the nets are still in the water. So that's why I kind of hold them for a bit. And then, you know, so hey, we're there, side of the river, 2 a.m., waiting for, like, we're sitting by the river, by the nets. I've got already, like, a male platypus in the car. And I can, and I hear knocking from inside the car. And so it's all, like, you know, pitch dark, head torch. I'm setting the mood, you know, middle of nowhere. And I go to the car and I see that the platypus has escaped from the pillowcase. So it's in the car. It's a male platypus, big one, big spurs. And it's running around in the car. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to have to go in there and try and get it. And so I jump in the car into like the passenger seat and I close the door behind me. And now I'm like, I need to catch this platypus. And it's running around in circles inside the car, under the seats.
Oh.
And there was this, you know, I'm sure it was more terrified than I was. But there was this scene where it's clawing on like the, it went up on the seats and it was like running around on like the sides of the car. And so I had this, like, it was like this, like, it reminded me of this, like, the Exorcist scene, right? When it's, like, running on the ceiling there. Yeah, and this, like, huge platypus, and I'm trying to, like, catch it, and, you know, without obviously getting spurred. At some point, it started going under the, like, the front of the car and starting to tear the fluff in the electric wiring there. And I was like, oh.
Fiery little things.
Yeah, but at some point I just, yeah, so all right, I give up. There's no way I can catch it inside a car. So I just opened the door, let it out, and then I caught it outside. So that was the, yeah. But,
oh, there you go.
to go back to why platypuses have venomous spurs. So it's not to defend themselves against predators. Because otherwise you'd ask yourself, then why don't female platypuses have venomous spurs? Because they female platypuses are born with like a vestigial spur. So it's not like a...
It's not like a full dimorphism.
Yeah, exactly. Our, you know, prevailing hypothesis is that like we see that venom, the amount of venom in the spurs increases during the breeding season. We see males fighting, and we see a lot of scarring on males during the breeding season. And so our, like, you know, like the conclusion is that they use it to fight each other. So male platypuses become territorial during the breeding season. So like the definition between like a home range, it's like kind of the area you inhabit, versus a territory is like a place where you actually defend, you know, in terms of like a... you know, like if you're living in a town, obviously you're not very territorial about the town, but you might be territorial about your home. So platypuses during the breeding season become territorial and they'll fend off other males and fight for, yeah. So I'm sure they, you know, they develop like in other animals, like they develop certain resistance.
Well, that's what, yeah, exactly. Do the males have a resistance to the venom? I don't know how you would test for that ethically, but yeah, that'd be, do they have a way of fighting it off? That's kind of an open question, I guess.
Yeah.
Yes, we haven't properly tested that one, but the venom, yeah, definitely.
You would need to know how they would react to the, like, how do you know the pain indicators for a platypus? how do you know how it's responding? That's really interesting, though. Wow.
When you look at an animal, it's really hard to gauge if it's in pain or not. You know, you can try and look at, like, a behavioral change if you know what your baseline is, but, like, when you encounter an animal... Yeah, it's hard to gauge. But I have this, I have these nets that are, they're like chambered, and they're nets that are designed to funnel animals, platypuses, into chambers that they can't come out of. And so there was one case where I had, it starts like a bad joke, a male platypus, a female platypus, and a catfish. So that's...
the joke.
Yeah, that's the joke, right? Like, And so the in that situation, so catfish, they also have spurs, and not spurs, what, spikes.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
Spikes, right? And yeah, quite painful. So I'm not too sure what went on there, but when I retrieved the platypuses, I did notice like the female platypus was quite seemed very like sedated, like she was quite docile for a very long time. And so it's hard to know what went on there, but it was there kind of during the breeding season. So whether, you know, maybe it was spurred by a male or spiked by a catfish, but
so the catfish was probably pretending to be a platypus. That's what I heard. You can never tell who you're meeting on the internet. That's a fact. So
dangerous place.
One of the things I've read about is that platypuses have some sort of electroreception. Like they have the ability to sense electricity underwater when they're hunting prey.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Yeah, so platypuses have a very sensitive bill. It's and they're packed with two types of receptors. One is like you say, an electroreceptor that can pick up minute electric signals in the water. And the other set of receptors are mechanoreceptors or motion sensors. So platypuses, they close their eyes and ears when they dive. They can dive for extended periods of time. They can hold their breath for like up to 8 minutes.
Wow.
They dive in and then blindlessly in terms of like, you know, eyesight, but they have these sensors. And so they pick up and the way they forage is like they go down to the bottom of the creek or river and kind of move their bill from side to side. And like, move away, like, you know, put it in between leaf litter and between like submerged logs and whatnot and you know, gravel and things like that. And they'll pick up those signals, those electric signals emitted by what we discussed, like those, you know, all those spinous bugs in the water, the big ones. When I say big, I mean, you know, like about a centimeter, 10 millimeters, or five. Yeah, so they'll pick up on that, and then it's a bit like it's filter feeding almost. So when we catch platypuses, one thing that I do is they suck their prey along with anything else. It's not very targeted in the sense, you know, they don't go like a shark, but they're just kind of filter feed through that. And then they'll surface. And so platypuses, they don't have any teeth. They have these grinding pads. They'll, incidentally, a platypus is born with a single tooth that they use to tear through the egg. and then cute. That too spawned off. Yeah, I know. So weird, right? So it's like this one-time tool. You just tear the egg and that's it. Yeah, so they'll mush up, they'll grind their all this like muck and prey and things like that. And they have these cheek pouches in the sides of, like, I don't know if you, like, there's a bit of space there. So I, like, when I catch a platypus and I, it's like a sleeping platypus, and I open its bill and I have this special spoon. It's like a cocktail spoon or something. And I, like, scoop out all that muck from their cheek pouches to understand what they're eating, and look at also, like, in terms of, we've been studying, like, the impact of bushfires and droughts on platypuses. And so one way is to understand how they're dealing with these, like, extreme events is to monitor as well what they're eating and food availability. So anyway, so we do that. And in the past, like, you know, researchers had to put all of that muck under a microscope and try and discern what's there. But nowadays we can use genomics to really identify exactly what's there. So gives us a really accurate understanding of what they're eating.
I've got like 2 hours worth of questions, but we're kind of running out of time. But I want to say, I think we've probably really, I hope, have inspired the curiosity of the many, aspiring biologists in our audience. I know a lot of people are fascinated by nature, and monsters fit right into that because they make us think about what's possible and what's not possible. And the platypus as an animal really kind of stretches the bounds of what kind of powers and skills a mammal can have. My last question before we go to our wrap up is this: how much can we tell about the platypus? How much of this is coming from, like, convergent evolution?
Yeah.
Like the bill as a feeding mechanism. Obviously, they exist on ducks, but here it is on a platypus.
Yeah.
What's going on there? And, like, these characteristics that they have, how much can we discern from the fossil record about the ancient versions? Like you said, their receptors on the bill. Does the fossil record suggest that those receptors were there millions of years ago? You know, what's new? What's old? Yeah. That kind of question. So that's a little rambly, but you see, I think, where I'm going.
Yeah, what were you asking?
No, I've got the answer. So it's fine. So, okay, yeah, like leaving the best for last kind of thing. So evolutionary-wise, platypuses are part of what we call, like, the family, the monotremes. And their closest relative is the echidna. So the echidna is a terrestrial mammal that feeds on like termites and ants and things like that. So its closest relative is a landfaring animal, with spines on its back. And it's like what you would, they can, is like a, like the Australian version of a hedgehog, really, or a porcupine. Evolutionary wise, these monotremes, like, our common ancestor in terms of the theory of evolution, is about 200 million years ago. So when you're, in terms of, like, placing where did the platypus came from, we're talking about, like, our ancestor, our mammalian ancestor that, like, we share with the platypus was this, like, weird egg-laying animal that shared Earth with dinosaurs. So that divergent happened even before we diverged from marsupials, like the the Australian version of mammals. And so because of that, like, they have all of these, like, you know, like, because their lineage is so, like, rooted deep in time, they have all of these, like, weird combinations of, especially, like, being still an egg-laying mammal, and mammal being, like, they still have, the platypus have a mammary gland that secrete milk, and the puggles, those, like, baby platypuses, they lap. The platypuses don't have teats, so they don't really suckle, but they have they lap that milk from the platypus.
I'm sorry, did you just say puggles?
I know, so cute.
Oh, it is
so
adorable. Yeah. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. Also, like I'm trying, the collective noun of a platypus is a pandemonium of platypuses.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh, that's great.
And so
I thought it was going to be platitudes. Yeah, so, what?
Yeah. Or a puggle.
Puggle, yeah. And there is some use puddle as well, which is also it's very cute as well. So you take a pick. I don't think there's like a formal, you know, collective nouns is really kind of this obscure thing.
A quick insert about collective nouns for animals in English. I mistakenly thought this was a Victorian-era invention, but it actually dates back to medieval hunting terminology. Schools of fish, flocks of birds, herds of horses. These feel pretty mundane, but they're all nouns that refer to a group of one class of animals. Concocting more specific terms became a kind of courtly entertainment, and even though these terms don't have a governing body of authorities who affirm the correctness of any particular word, it's not uncommon to run across lists on the internet that are written as though there were. And, it won't surprise listeners, there are a lot of puns made from such things. This practice is a kind of collective noun known as a term of venery. Now, this may cause some eyebrow raises for listeners who recognize that particular word as meaning a kind of sexual excessiveness, but an alternate meaning goes back to hunting with dogs. And I won't hound you with the mounting layers of meanings those metaphors suggest, but these lists do come up again and again. So you may find joy in knowing a murder of crows, a parliament of owls, a sleuth of bears, a congregation of crocodiles, and so on. But you're not likely to hear most of them actually used by the people who study these creatures. Still, if I had the strength, I would not be above throwing a group of stranded whales back into the ocean. After all, I am a podcaster.
Yeah, so to answer your question, the origins of the platypus is a terrestrial faring animal, much bigger than what it is today. The ancestors of the platypus were these like big animals that were walking on land, really. And so I think all of these features of a duck bill and receptors and toe webbing. Platypuses have the second densest fur in the animal kingdom, in the animal world, right? So, you know, that's another feature. They have these like very specialized, fat that gives them a really good insulation. And so I would think that all of these are really like convergent traits that have evolved to be adapted with, you know, the environment. And it's quite a, you know, in Australia, it's quite a specialized niche. I mean, mm-hmm. Placental mammals are considered like superior in a sense. If you put a placental or a marsupial or a monotreme in the same place, I think placental mammals usually like outcompete the others. So, you know, it's quite a specialized niche that is like a shared by, you know, fish and ducks and, yeah, but it's I know like I've got a colleague of mine is kind of an evolutionary biologist, Mike Archer, and he, you know, some species can be considered as like dead end species. And so like there are like over time, the range of this family and the species have been contracting, you know, we're talking, you know, millions of years here. So, you know, in perspective. So, but potentially it could be like a dead end for, you know, for thinking about the millions of years to come and life on Earth. Like, so maybe like some platypuses will be outcompeted by other animals and other traits.
Wow. Well, we feel like we could talk about this topic for hours, and we really appreciate you coming on the show, Gilad, to talk about this unique animal and all the interesting facts that you've shared. We've just got one final question that we want to ask you, which we ask all of our guests, and that is, what's your favorite monster?
So many good monsters out there. Let's see. Corporate sociopaths, is that considered a monster? Or?
Every day.
Yes.
Every day.
Yeah.
No. There's this, I'm kidding, but there's, I would probably say I play Dungeons and Dragons. I love role-playing and all of these kind of, and I'm like a tabletop gamer and I do all of that. That's kind of my nerdy aspect. But I would say like over the years, playing Dungeons and Dragons, my favorite monster would be the Mind Flayers.
Ooh, yeah.
Have you had that one before?
No one said that before, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
I don't.
Yeah. You want to explain it?
Yeah.
So Mind Flayers are these like...
scientific names, the Illithids, right?
Nice. Yeah, good. The Illithids, right. I can maybe... yeah, so they're like considered... the scourge of sentient creatures. And they have these psionic abilities and they consume, they basically feed off of people's brains.
Mm-hmm.
And they can
like zombies.
Yeah, well, yeah, but they consume like their knowledge.
Yeah, they take your identity and your knowledge and your everything and then they suck it out of your brain and they can mind control you and dominate you. And they have a, they have a hive mind leader, right? If I remember correctly.
Yeah. The elder brain.
Yeah.
Which they kind of,
So everything they're doing is in service to that. It's really, it's super creepy. It's super creepy. The last
thing. Yeah. Good.
I think one of them is one of the secret rulers of Waterdeep, maybe, if I remember correctly. It's been a minute. So,
nice answer then.
Yeah, very, very, very cool monsters. They have like octopus heads on human body sort of thing, humanoid bodies.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's a good one. Within the boundaries of copyright, we'll put some images in the show notes.
Good stuff.
Thank you so much for sharing this time with us. This has been so cool.
Thank you. Such a beloved animal to Australia. And I just know I get asked about the platypus all the time here. People think it's this incredible creature through to it's some kind of abomination. So it's really fun to talk about this with someone who knows something.
about
the creature.
This will be a good augmentation. All of my previous knowledge was from a documentary my kids were watching about two kids who were on summer break and they had a platypus as a pet.
Maybe you can teach Perry some tricks.
Well, he is a platypus. They don't do much.
They're the only mammals to lay eggs.
Maybe he'll lay an egg.
Cool. See you tomorrow.
What?
It's a Phineas and Ferb joke.
One joke that we have is like, what happens if you get spurred? Do you remember the 80s TV show Manimal?
Oh my God, yes.
Manimal.
I was just literally talking about that at lunch today. That is crazy.
So,
really?
Yeah.
So we have this, if you get spurred, you become like a manipus. And you can like transform into like a spurred creature.
So
you know,
now he can become a falcon,
a cougar
or a black puma of some sort, and now also a platypus.
There you go.
Which it turns out has actually got a lot of useful power, so maybe not the worst thing. So,
that is
fantastic. Well, I hope you have much success in your continued research. This is so cool.
Me too. It's a really important research.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And thank you as well for helping spur on the curiosity of our listeners, because I think you'll be inspiring people to go learn more about these fascinating creatures. So,
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard the second half of our interview with Dr. Gilad Bino about the amazing platypus. Check our show notes for links to other things mentioned in the show.
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
Mo- Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as The Accidental Creative and The Sit Down. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you for putting our word sounds into your ears. We really appreciate you making us a part of your listening life.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Save big money and transform your home with new appliances now at Menards. We offer the lowest prices and the largest in-stock appliance selection ready to take home today. Check out top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Upgrade your home and save big money on new appliances at Menards. Shop our entire selection of appliance options online today at Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.